Welcome to the latest episode of Diverse Voices Book Review. My interview today is with John Harris. He is the co-author of an autobiography of Edgerrin James, From Gold Teeth to Gold Jacket, My Life in Football and Business. Edgerrin James was a Hall of Fame running back, played for the University of Miami in college, played for the Indianapolis Colts and the Pros and some other teams, best known for being part of the potent offense led by Hall of Fame quarterback Peyton Manning of the Indianapolis Colts. I wanted to do this interview not only because I'm a fan of football, and I was especially a fan of the Indianapolis Colts when Peyton Manning and Edgerrin James was there, but also because this is the story of a football player who has all his money still. And I was very interested in learning how he was able to build the types of habits and financial management skills that allowed him to successfully pursue business after his football career. Stay tuned. Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest today is John Harris, co-author of an autobiography of Hall of Fame football player Edgerrin James, From Gold Teeth to Gold Jacket, My Life in Football and Business. John Harris is an award-winning journalist who has covered sports for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Toledo Blade, Tampa Bay Times, Fort Worth Star Telegram, Austin American Statesman, ESPN's Enscape, so on and so forth. And this is his first book. So, John, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Hopeton, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So when I saw the book, I'm from New Orleans, so I was a Peyton Manning fan.
Okay.
And I was a fan of those Indianapolis Colts.
Yeah.
And I always wondered, how did the stretch play work? how did they make that stretch play work? And I was a fan of Edgerrin James, even though I was here in UT Austin. Of course, we are all Ricky Williams fans, right, being here in UT Austin. But I got to ask you, John, how did you become connected with Edgerrin James?
I kind of take it as a lesson of being good at what you do. Professional, I've been a sports writer for almost four decades. Made a lot of contacts. One of those contacts was a gentleman named Charles Bennett. He's a forensic accountant, a big numbers guy. Used to work for the NFL Players Association. He was Gene Upshaw's right-hand man. He also worked for the NBA Players Association. What he did, he studied teams' financial numbers, and the research that he did would help teams calculate their salary caps. So I did a lot of stories on the NFL and the NBA. During that time, our paths crossed many times. We developed a relationship. I later found out that he was Edgerrin James' accountant. And one day Charles called me and said, EJ, as his friends call him, wants to write a book. And I told him about you. And he wants to talk to you. I did not know Edgerrin, been in a few of his interviews, but we didn't know each other. We talked a few times, felt each other out. He felt comfortable with me. I felt comfortable with him. And the rest is history, I guess you could say.
Well, the thing that excited me most about the book is we have a successful football player that kept his money.
Yes.
And, you know, we always hear these stories of these famous athletes who made a lot of money and lost a lot of money. But it was a really inspiring story of his grandmother and his grandmother teaching him the value of money. Talk about learning about that story, about how his grandmother helped him to become very astute when it comes to money.
Yeah, he grew up one of five brothers, did not grow up with his father. Mother raised him. His grandmother played a huge role in his life, spent a lot of time with his grandparents after school. He talked about all the hours he would spend on the couch, her couch, watching television. And when he finally came into money, when he went to the NFL, he wanted to give her everything, as he said, because she had meant the world to me. And he told her, I want to buy you a house. And she told him, I don't need a house. I'm very comfortable where I am. I want you to take care of your money, take care of your family, take care of yourself. You've been given a blessing. And some people give their blessings away. And you have to understand that. And it, to him, was such a revelation. He wrote it down, he said, and always remembered it because he so many people were coming at him, family, friends, people from the neighborhood asking for money. And he said, he was this one woman who had done everything for me. She didn't want anything from me. And it just taught him a valuable lesson. There's another part in the book where his mother talks about how he got so much from his grandmother because she was all about money, M-O-N-E-Y. That was her thing. She just embedded that in his mind. So from a young age, he was focused on money, driven by money, and very disciplined in when he did get it, to take care of it, to not go crazy, to not buy 100 cars, to not buy all the bling. And know what was most important was taking care of his family.
So how did he resist the temptations? Some years ago, I met somebody who played a couple of seasons of football. And he told me that when he was on the team and he was, you know, he was only making $700,000-$800,000 a year, that what caught him was trying to keep up with the players making $5 million a year, and how there was sort of this, in his mind, at least, this culture of everybody had to show that money. You had to show that money. So what was it about him that enabled him to resist that groupthink of show that money, spend that money, show that money?
When he decided he was going to go pro after his junior year at the University of Miami, that's a time when a lot of guys, when they make that decision, they sign with an agent, they get an advance, they buy their first BMW or Lexus or Mercedes, they get a bunch of gold, and they just show it off, and it's a big thing. He stayed at the University of Miami. He didn't hire an agent right away. He continued to stay at his campus apartment. He trained with the strength and conditioning coach at the University of Miami. He explained it this way. He grew up, his mother was a practicing Jehovah's Witness. They didn't celebrate Christmas. When he was a little boy, he did not get Christmas gifts. He and his brothers did not get gifts. They learned to do without. It was a hard education to learn, but he learned to not really want or demand things. So when he got older and he said, I'm months away from making millions of dollars as a football player, I didn't need anything. I was used to really not having anything. He describes himself as coming from nothing. And that's kind of how he, growing up in Immokalee, Florida, that's how he described it. He still had the same car that he bought when he was 14 years old when he went to the NFL. He just continued to fix it up and trick it up and all that, put the wheels on it and the rims. But he was comfortable just with him. It wasn't important to him to prove to other guys that he had money, that he could do this. He had more than any of them, actually. His first year in the NFL, he made more money in his first season than any rookie had ever made before. He had the cash, but it wasn't important for him to tell other people what he had.
So he grew up in Immokalee, Florida, one of the poor cities in Florida, but in a county, Collier, which was one of the richest counties in the state. Yes. So talk about how that impacted him, being in a poor city in a rich county.
That's a good question. That was in his first chapter, talking about Immokalee, contrasting Immokalee and a lot of the other rich areas. And he said, I asked him if that was a, you know, oh my God, this is where I live. We live in squalor. We're poor. He said, no, it showed me what was there, what was potentially was available to you. It's all out there for you. It showed me that where I lived was just one facet of it, that there are other people doing bigger, better things, and that I could get that. And so I thought that was an interesting explanation from his point. He never looked at things to me from a negative standpoint. He would take it, for him, I guess the glass was always half full. He saw something maybe where other people might be sad or depressed and do other things. He looked at it as a motivational factor. He would go to school earlier and work out before he went to school in high school to beat everybody to the punch. When he got to the NFL, when guys would go out to the club afterwards, he'd go back and work out at 2 or 3 in the morning while the other guys were still hanging out in the club. So that was his way of always beating everybody to the punch to get that lifestyle, to get that life that he wanted. He realized that he was going to have to sacrifice and discipline himself to do that.
And talking about sacrificing and disciplining himself, he started going to Georgia with his uncles to harvest watermelons. Making $100 to $200 a day as a team, working 7 to 7, 7 days a week during the summer. That had to have a major impact on his work ethic.
Yeah, he said that's where I got my grown man strength from when I was a little kid. Taking those watermelons and hauling them. I talked to his high school coach, and he said he tried it a couple times. And he said he had played college football. He was, you know, strong guy, lifted weights. And he said, I was sore for like days afterwards. And he said, just imagine this kid doing this for summer after summer after summer. And just his, you know, he developed it. Some pictures in the book when he was in high school, and he just looks like a giant amongst his teammates. He was a full grown man when he was a junior in high school. So that played a huge role. It also taught him saving money, because he was around a lot of older men. Somebody he described as crackheads. He learned a lot. He learned a lot about, I guess, street sense, people coming at you, the con game. He was around these grown men listening to their conversations. He was there with his uncles and his grandfather, but he was also around a lot of people that were a lot older than him. So he absorbed all of that, took in the good, got rid of the bad, and just decided after he bought his first car that I was never going to depend on anybody for anything the rest of my life.
And his mother used to take him to hang out. Hanging yeah. out with up to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, just, and I mean, I grew up in the housing projects in New Orleans. I lived in the housing projects in New Orleans for 6 years. So I know about the hanging out.
it's a very interesting family dynamic. His mother leaned on him heavily. He said that he became the man of the house. He was the one that she trusted to go out there and, you know, help out the family. And he said, hey, I'm not going to tell you what I did. I did some things that they could have gone sideways. They could have gone left. And maybe you never would have read about Edgerrin James, the football player. But she trusted me that I would make the right decisions, that I would use common sense, that I wouldn't put myself in danger, and I wouldn't do things to embarrass the family. Because remember, he had one of five brothers, three of his brothers have spent time in prison. And as he says, I don't know why I was the one, the chosen one, why I was blessed to be able to do the things that I did, considering, you know, somehow some of my other brothers ended up.
And playing for the University of Miami, I mean, legendary University of Miami teams. I mean, that really had to play a major role in terms of him going to the next level, because those University of Miami teams produced some of the greatest players of all time.
Yeah, the talent level there was high. He said he learned, though, going there about how good he was, because there were so many five-star, four-star, All-American type players there. And he got on the field, and after a time, he said, hey, I'm as good as any of these guys. In fact, I may be better than these guys. And his confidence soared. You know, he became this, just played his game. You know, he didn't think about it. He wasn't intimidated. He was highly respected amongst his players, amongst his peers, amongst his coaches. They had wrestling. I mean, sports are so different now. They had wrestling matches in the locker room. You got called out, you had to wrestle somebody. And everybody tells me Reggie Wayne, one of his teammates with the Colts and also with Miami, and it's one of his coaches, never lost a match. He said, well, he was going up against linebackers, linemen, and it was, you know, Edge never lost. He was just that tough guy, and they respected him for his, you know, his ability on the field, and they respected him for off the field. He was just always a very quiet guy. Didn't talk a lot, but you got to watch out for those silent guys, right?
Right, right. And then his mother, Julie James, she said, and I'm taking part of this quote here, he had a grind that was unreal. And if there was one word I would use to describe Edgerrin, just from reading the book, of something I would share with people who are trying to get to the next level of success, you have to be willing to do the grind. And yes, he was more than willing to do the grind.
Yeah. And that's the thing. There's no shortcuts in this book. And that's the lesson that I hope that, you know, especially younger athletes take. There are no easy routes. He had to be disciplined, you know, whether it was for football or with your money. You have to set goals, you know, and you have to be willing to sacrifice to reach those goals. And that, I think the title of the book, it's kind of ironic, gold teeth to gold jacket. The gold teeth, obviously, he had that look. He had that gold South Florida grill, the gold jacket, a super Hall of Fame jacket. But people looked at him of that look and miscalculated. you know, described as, looked at as a thug, because he had the dreads, he had the gold grill, and he was this quiet guy that didn't say a lot. So people made assumptions, and making those assumptions, you didn't realize how hard he worked, how much he was, you know, he was on the grind. And he used that to his advantage, he said, especially when it started coming to financial situations. People would underestimate him because of his look.
Yeah, matter of fact, they tried to lowball him when he got drafted and marketing deals were being cut. And there was companies that tried to lowball him for the price of playing cards.
Yeah. I had one of his agents told me that he was the only guy that when he finally would sign card deals, he would sign them right away and send them back. He said other players, you know, they'd get around to it eventually. Not only did he sign them and get them back, he wanted to know right then and there, when am I getting paid? He was just very diligent in what he did. Yeah, the cards were brought up with him and Ricky Williams, you know, UT's finest. And Ricky Williams, they were both taking that draft. And he found out that Ricky Williams was getting more per card than he was. And he was drafted one spot ahead of Ricky Williams. Ricky Williams was a Heisman Trophy winner, you know, had a much more of a national profile than Adrian James did at that time. And he was like, well, I was drafted ahead of him. I don't really care that he won the Heisman. I know you need me to do this credit, this card set. So guess what? I'm not going to sign with you. And according to him, eventually they came around and he got more money per card than Ricky Williams did. Those things were really important to him. He just felt like I deserve to get my value. I know my value. I'm not asking for more, but I expect to get what I deserve.
And he even did that with the holdout before he signed with the Colts.
Yeah, that in itself is fascinating, Hopton. I mean, you think about it, he didn't have an agent when he got drafted. He had his brother, half-brother, an attorney, and a school lobbyist formed Team Edrin. And they basically would interview all the agent candidates. And he would direct them to him. They would interview him. They'd all get back together and huddle. And he did not, when he got drafted, he didn't have an agent. Everybody was telling him, you're making a mistake. You know, you shouldn't do this. You don't know what you're doing. He didn't listen to anybody. He got drafted. Then he started looking for an agent. He settled on Lee Steinberg, who at that time, if people aren't familiar, the movie Jerry Maguire was patterned after him. Lee Steinberg was the giant among sports agents at that time. Here's this 21-year-old kid from South Florida with his grill telling Lee Steinberg, well, I'm not paying you the 3% standard agent fee. I got myself drafted. You weren't around back then. You didn't wine and dine me. So I'd love to be with you, but I'm not paying you the 3%. And Lee Steinberg went for it, which tells me a lot about this guy, this kid who just, he was going to follow his path. It didn't matter what anybody thought. He got Lee Steinberg. He held out a training camp. Fans in Indianapolis are irate. They wanted Ricky Williams. They didn't want this kid with the dreads coming to middle America. He holds out, so he misses training camp. People are really getting upset. He finally signs for a record contract. I think it's $49 million at that time. This is 1999. Biggest contract ever for a running back. Made more money his first year, $15 million than any rookie ever, even more than Peyton Manning did in his first year. Comes in, leads the league in rushing his first 2 years. The Colts go from 3-13 to 13-3 his first year. Just an amazing turnaround. He said, you have to know your worth, your leverage. And at that time in my career, I had the leverage. I used it.
So one of the things I found interesting, and I wasn't aware of it, or I don't remember being aware of it, is that the media was trying to pit Edrin James against Ricky Williams. And they didn't fall for it. They didn't fall, which is a credit to Edrin James and Ricky Williams, that they didn't fall for the I'm better than you competition that the media was trying to create.
Yeah, we decided to do a chapter on that. Edrin reached out to Ricky, and he was willing to talk about it. And I just thought it was for both of them to give their perspective on how they viewed it. Edrin always felt like he was the underdog. He didn't know Ricky. So there was no reason for him to feel, you know, I respected him as a football player. I didn't know him. I also knew what people were trying to do. they were trying to get us to, you know, talk about each other or downgrade each other. And I think he used feeling like he was slighted as motivation, but it wasn't anything personal towards Ricky. It was just how he felt. Ricky, on the other hand, talked about it in the same way. He knew Edrin just from afar, and they never really became friends. I think it was like a mutual type of respect of thing. Ricky, though, does get into interesting aspects, just talks about maybe he would have done things a little differently. The way he was perceived coming out, the way maybe people looked at him, he said, maybe I should have sat back a little bit and waited. You know, he said, the University of Texas provided me with an atmosphere where I felt like I could really be myself. And I carried that mindset into the NFL, and maybe I was a little naive about how NFL teams and how NFL owners view that, you know, free spirit type of thing. He said, doing it again, maybe I would have done it differently. I feel like I had a really good career. I wonder what it would have been like possibly to play with Peyton Manning, but, you know, that's the way it is. But I thought it was important for both of their voices to be heard so people can make their own decisions about it. Because Ricky hasn't talked a lot about his career in that regard. So I thought it's a really good a good read for people, you know, especially Ricky Williams fans, to just kind of get their perspective on how he felt about that situation. He was disappointed that he didn't go ahead of Edrin, but, you know, c'est la vie.
Right. I remember that, actually. I mean, I watched the games, especially his junior year, sophomore, junior years. I saw the great runs. I saw him break the records and everything. And he made some interesting decisions. And of course, yeah, I did hear that regret in his voice reading that chapter, a little bit of a regret there. But I think the overall story I saw simply was the media tried to pit them publicly against each other, and they didn't fall for it.
No, I have a lot of respect for both of them in that regard. But I think they were both secure enough in who they were, and they were intelligent enough to see not to let the media control the narrative. It's my life. I'm going to live it, you know, the way I feel like I need to live it. Because at the end of the day, that's all you really have is, you know, like Edrin says, he turned down millions of dollars in marketing opportunities, commercial opportunities through the years if he changed his look. And his explanation was, well, one day I was going to have to go back. I wasn't always going to be a football player. I wasn't always going to be in the limelight. One day you're going to have to go back, in a sense, where you came from. And I just felt like for me, it was more important to just be Edrin James than to be some creation to make a few more dollars. And trust me, he loved making money. So for him not to do that tells you just a lot about him, because he could have added a lot more money to his bank account if he had decided to do that.
So I want to talk a little bit about Tony Dungy, his former coach of the Indianapolis Colts. He said he treated you like a man, respected you like a man, and said that family came first, not team. And that was so important, because I've had nephews that played college football. I've had a stepson that played college football. And I will tell you that these coaches create an environment where they really want that player to put everything behind playing football. And it was such a breath of fresh air to hear the message that Tony Dungy was giving to players like Edrin James.
Yeah, mad respect. And you know, I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not going to psychoanalyze anything here. But I do believe Edrin, given that, you know, his dad wasn't really around, kind of maybe looked at Tony in that way, that a coach, an African-American coach, you know, well-respected coach, a guy that, you know, he respects you because you're a great talent, but he looked at you as a man, a family man. And I think that just had a tremendous impact on Edrin, not only then, but, at, you know, throughout his life. And he's a guy that you could play for. You know, he's a guy that you don't mind giving it all for. Because at the end of the day, Tony Dungy cared about you as a person. You know, the football was great, but he also was concerned about you. He respected you. He loved you as a man and as a person. And professional athletes will tell you that means the world to them.
The funniest story in the book I really enjoyed was Edrin's grandmother coming to see him play. He's taken out of the game, I believe, in the third quarter. She meets the owner of the Indianapolis Colts, and she tells the owner of the Colts, don't take my son out the game when I'm coming to see him play.
That was hilarious. I could just imagine that. And, you know, Edwin said he was kind of laughing. He said, oh, grandma, he said, I don't care who he is. That was, and that, you could just, you know, you could see a grandmother doing that, that kind of thing. That's my boy out there, my baby out there. And yeah, that was funny. His, and he said, and Jim Irsay, the owner, said her grip was like, it was like a steel grip. He said, this woman was like in her 80s. And he said, she shook my hand and it was like, oh my God, you gotta be kidding me. So he said, yeah, I see where all that came from with Edrin. I see where it all came from.
So he's financially successful. He has sons that play sports, one football, one basketball.
Yeah.
And he talks about, he comes up in a household where he wants to do this for his mom, but he recognizes that their storyline is different from him. And he recognizes that his sons have to find something that is going to drive them.
Yes. Yeah, that's in the chapter. And that was something that I'm glad you went there, because, you know, with all the stuff about, it's kind of related to the NIL, which is going on right now with college athletes having marketing opportunities. But yeah, his story is one typical of the famous athlete. One of his offspring decides to play. And you think about it now with LeBron James and his son, you know, it's like, can you ever get out from under that shadow of who your dad is and just stake out your own identity? And he was like, for me as a running back, I wanted it. I was hungry for it. I tasted it. My son, who's playing football, he has everything he is ever going to need financially. So somehow he's going to have to dig down deep to make him, you know, make it worth for him to take that punishment as a running back, to get hit, to get hurt, because he doesn't have what that's the only thing I can give him. I can give him, we sit down and we study tape. We go over things. He's smart. He understands all the X's and O's of football. I can't give him me. I can't give him what's inside of me. He said, that's what I'll be curious to see how he develops over time.
And I haven't really seen it much in football, but in basketball, we got Steph Curry, who's dad. Dale Curry played basketball. In baseball, we got Ken Griffey Jr., whose dad played. Ken Griffey, we got Barry Bonds, his dad Bobby Bonds played. And so we've actually gotten some Hall of Famers, or in my opinion, should be in the Hall of Fame. Barry Bonds, he was a Hall of Famer before the steroid stuff came out, his performance. Yeah. So we've seen that level of success, but I don't really know enough about football, or just can't think of players who are the sons of famous football players who've taken it to a whole nother level.
Yeah, I mean, it's his son is smaller than his dad. You know, I've watched a lot of video of him, Eden, E-D-E-N, James. He's very good. In fact, Edrin said his style reminded him of Fred Taylor, who played for Jacksonville. And he's good friends with Fred Taylor, so he asked Fred Taylor from time to time to talk to him, coach him, guide him, because he said his running style is more like Fred Taylor's. He's more of a home run hitter type, big runs. Right. He said, my game is grit and grind. He said, I can give him that grit and grind, but he's going to have to go out there and get it. He said, we can combine those two elements, you know, the home run effect and the grit and grind. He said, he'll really be special. His son that plays basketball, who's Edrin Jr., he's going into his senior year in high school in Orlando, Florida. He's a top 50 recruit right now. I've watched a lot of video of him. He's moving up the charts. If I was going to pick one of the two to have that success, because Edrin's already talking about maybe him NBA second or third year. So I would look at Edrin Jr. Because football, you know, you got to go through it. You know, you can't leave school early. It's a process. It's a maturity. It's, so such a physical sport. For basketball, these guys just jump to the next level in a heartbeat. He said he's living a dream through Edrin, because Edrin wanted to be a basketball player. He said, I just wasn't good enough. I didn't have a left hand. So I think he's kind of reliving that through his through Edrin Jr.
The last thing I want to talk about is he said that from the beginning, he has surrounded his boys with those kids that were me growing up. So he hasn't given them a pampered life. So I can remember several years ago, I sent my daughter to a summer camp, And she came back, you know, her and a couple of her friends were like, wow, they were asking me why I had never heard of this gang or that rap song. And so my daughter herself, you know, get a little taste of, you know, I think if you're a kid with a little bit of privilege, you need to be exposed to much more than that so you can have respect for that.
Yeah, he said he kind of sat back and watched those moments to see how his sons were going to respond to it. Because that's where you find out, you know, you get hit in the mouth. These kids know who their dad is. They're going to test them. They're going to challenge him. So he was curious to see if they were going to buck up or if they were going to back down. He felt like he saw enough in their responses during those occasions that he felt confident that, okay, I guess they are serious about it. So he told Eden, the football player, hey, I'm only going, you know, one day that you miss practice or whatever, I'm done with you. So he's very tough on them, very demanding. They follow a routine. I visited him in Orlando a few months ago, and his son was shooting, every day he shoots 500 three-pointers. There's a little gym there. And he was just shooting three-pointers, like 500 every day. I mean, so he's putting in the work. His son's put in the work. He said, you have to put in the work to be that level. If you want to reach that level of success, it's like we talked about earlier, you got to be willing to be on that grind.
So what was the one or two things that you were most surprised to find out about Edgerrin James?
I think it's from the financial end. For me personally, my favorite parts of the book are when he talks about finances. His mindset, he's really big into Black entrepreneurship. He's a business owner. He wants to see Black businesses support each other. He wants to see Black people support Black businesses. And he is just, mind is always working ways to create wealth. Ways to teach his children to understand wealth, generational wealth, but he just has a drive in him to make money. I didn't know that. I knew he was a great football player. I knew he was financially successful, but I didn't realize, you know, I guess the backstory, I mean, how he got to that point, you know, how he has motivated other athletes, peers. He's well-respected in the NFL community. Everybody knows that Edge keeps his money. The way it's described by Clinton Portis, who's in the book, one of his good friends who has had some financial issues, is that Edge just, he was not willing to take a loss. We're willing, you know, somebody comes to us with an investment, you add a couple percentage points on it, we're good. Edgerrin, if you're not going to put money into the investment along with him, he's not going to talk to you. He's not going to deal with you. He was not willing to take a loss. And I think if you want to look at, I mean, you read about these stories of athletes, you know, losing over, giving signed over rights for people to have control of their finances and they lose millions of dollars. Edgerrin's like, no one ever has had control of my money. I know where every penny goes. Nothing comes out without my knowledge. So he was not worried what you thought about him, whether you thought he was the financial wizard or not. What was most important to him was keeping all of his money. So I guess his passion, and desire just to be this financial global wizard, I guess, was the thing that I took most from it, not really knowing that part of him. But now I know where it comes from, and I know where his drive comes from.
John Harris, co-author of an autobiography of Edgerrin James, Hall of Fame football player, From Gold Teeth to Gold Jacket, My Life in Football and Business. Do you have a website for the book?
You can just hit me up at JD Harris Jr. at yahoo.com. You can always go to yahoo.com, or you can go to our publishing site, skyhorsepublishing.com. And the book is available through all the traditional, you know, bookstores, skyhorse.com, John Harris, my website, my email, a lot of different ways to get it. I appreciate the time to talk about this book. I'm very excited about it, and just hope more people know about the Edgerrin James story.
John Harris, this is a really good book, and I think it's really an instructive and inspirational book, especially for young athletes trying to figure out their way. So thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Hopkins, so much for having me. I appreciate it. Best of luck to you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopkins Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.